You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the September 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Game Show. Jason Kelsey, Richard Sherman, and Nate Burleson may be football prodigies, but they weren't natural-born commentators. They took a crash course at the NFL's broadcast boot camp. Vanity Fair has a sneak peek at the class of 2025 by Tom Clute. With photographs by Roger Kisby. Opening photo, lights, camera, action. NFL Network anchor Chris Rose and running back Chase Edmonds call a game. For 9 seasons, Kevin Minter had one of the most demanding jobs in the NFL. An inside linebacker, he was responsible for relaying signals to teammates and delivering punishing hits to the opposition. But now, 4 years removed from his last snap, Minter has swapped his pads for a mic, his uniform for a crisply tailored suit, and is trying to make the cut in another ultra-competitive field, television. On a spring afternoon, I caught Minter playing the role of color commentator alongside NBC play-by-play announcer Paul Burmeister. For this simulated game, they stared at a monitor that showed last season's Week 2 contest between the Atlanta Falcons and Philadelphia Eagles. As Eagles star running back Saquon Barkley gashed the Atlanta defense early in the first quarter, Minter grimaced. Once a linebacker, always a linebacker. These Falcons got to step up in this run game, Minter said. After about 10 minutes, the simulation was over, and Minter looked like he had seen a ghost. Every player has a welcome to the NFL moment, a humbling episode that underlines the differences between the amateurs and pros. What Minter experienced here was probably the sports media equivalent. Calling a game, it turns out, isn't any easier than playing. That, he said to Burmeister, was something else. Meanwhile, inside a cavernous soundstage that was blanketed with a green screen, Chase Edmonds stood alongside NFL Network's Chris Rose. A 6-year running back who last played in 2023, Edmonds was set to call the same Falcons-Eagles game. But before they got underway, Rose got his partner loose. "Shake it out," he told Edmonds. The two wiggled their hands, extracting the nerves from their extremities. Moments later, with the camera rolling, they previewed the matchup as if millions were watching at home. The key for Atlanta, Edmonds explained, would be to establish the ground game. Once a running back, always a running back. Minter and Edmonds are among 24 current and former players trying to make the leap from the gridiron to the green room by way of the NFL's Broadcasting and Media Workshop, which is better known by its original, punchier title, the Broadcast Boot Camp. For 3 days in April, the campers gathered at the NFL's West Coast headquarters in Inglewood, California, where they were schooled by top executives, producers, and anchors. The program has become a prolific talent incubator, with alums scattered throughout the NFL's vast media ecosystem. Dan Orlovsky and Jason Kelsey on ESPN, Nate Burleson on CBS, and Richard Sherman on Prime Video. But the boot camp also serves to puncture misconceptions, namely that the commentating business is easy. When he was finished with the faux game broadcast, Minter admitted that it was harder than he expected. "I figured the hundreds of interviews I've had throughout my life somehow will apply to this," Minter told me. "It does not, and not in the slightest." Down the hall, other campers simulated a studio show. Former tight end Luke Wilson and ex-wide receiver Jason Avant sat behind a desk alongside NFL Network chief national reporter Steve Weich and Maurice Jones-Drew, a running back turned analyst and boot camp alum from 2009. From a control room, producers whipped up chyrons to correspond with the topics at hand. As the banner on screen asked which NFC team poses the biggest threat to the defending champion Eagles, Wilson made an impassioned case for the Los Angeles Rams and their quarterback, Matthew Stafford. "I've never seen a human being throw the ball so well as Matthew Stafford, and he's still doing it," he said. When they were finished, players were given feedback in private, a departure from the early days of the boot camp, when campers were evaluated in front of their peers by a panel of judges a la American Idol. Terry McLaurin, a star wide receiver for the Washington Commanders, was admonished for leaning too much on a verbal crutch. "If you overuse the word great," he said, reciting a familiar boot camp proverb, "then nothing's great." Kyle Long, a retired offensive lineman, was urged to paint a bigger picture and to avoid calling down-to-down results. "You get caught in the micro," he said. "Zoom out a little bit." Long came to the boot camp because, as he put it, reps are priceless. The mock game broadcast and studio shows held on the final day allow the campers to get experience on camera and behind the mic. But those simulations also double as auditions, as many boot camp alums have landed jobs on the backs of strong performances there. "It 100% changed my opportunity," said Jeff Saturday, an ESPN analyst who attended the boot camp in 2010. "All the feedback I got right away from NFL Network, ESPN, NBC, was all like, 'No, man, you have the ability to do this on a grander scale.'" While the program was created for players, the boot camp has become every bit as valuable for the league's media partners. If the first 2 days resemble training camp, the final day is a bit like the NFL draft combine, where prospects interview with coaches and perform a series of on-field drills. "The scouting side of it is very real," said Mark Teitelman, the lead game producer for Thursday Night Football on Prime Video and a part of the boot camp's faculty since 2021. "We are all always on the hunt for who's next." Next photos, camp is in session. Jason Avant, Eric Hendricks, Terry McLaurin, and Justin Reed. Luke Wilson, McLaurin and Brian Walters. Helmets at the NFL's West Coast headquarters. Noah Eagle and Stevie Johnson. 2 days earlier, this year's campers were welcomed by a relentlessly upbeat man named Jerry Madelon. The players had gathered in a screening room, the type of place where they normally chew over game tape. But this was no X's and O's session. Madelon, a communications coach and former talent executive at ESPN, led an hour-long PowerPoint presentation rattling off a flurry of industry best practices and tips of the trade, typically delivered in the form of a neatly wrapped aphorism. And in more photos, Snapchat. Steve Weich and J.J. Jansen. Tracy Perlman's notebook. A boot camp session. Michael Bennett and Jalon Smith. A commentating playbook. Paul Burmeister and Kyle Long. Jerry Madelon. "Your clothing should add to your attraction," Madelon said, "not become a distraction." "A commentator's appearance," he explained, "plays a crucial role in helping them connect with an audience whose attention span may be scattered." "The three ways we engage an audience," Madelon told them, "is how we look, how we sound, and what we say." He broke them down one by one. "Look, how we groom, our attire, our body language. Sound, our pitch, pace, pause, how we project our voice. What we say, the actual words. Now here's a chart. The Boot Camp Alumni Network. The NFL is America's most popular television show, and this training program serves as a pipeline for players turned pundits who go on to gab in studios and man the sidelines. Jason Kelce, arriving at boot camp in 2023, already co-hosting a hit podcast with brother Travis, Kelce has since landed a lucrative ESPN gig. Nate Burleson, a successful football analyst, Burleson can now also be found weekdays alongside Gail King on CBS Mornings. Jeff Saturday, this former Indianapolis Colts center and current ESPN fixture, credits the boot camp as his springboard for broadcasting. Richard Sherman, the ever-quotable star cornerback, joined the 2022 class and can now be found on Prime Video's Thursday Night Football. And Dan Orlovsky, a career backup QB, this former boot camper, is now a go-to analyst on ESPN's NFL Live and Monday Night Football. There was a lot of guidance like that as players cycled through a car wash of presentations and panels held in glassy conference rooms with names like Pick Six and Longest Yard. The league relocated to the space from Culver City in 2021, placing its offices a mere 50 yards from SoFi Stadium, home of the Rams and the Los Angeles Chargers. Campers arrived each day by bus with backpacks draped over their well-sculpted shoulders, giving the whole affair a back-to-school vibe. They meandered through the halls like students heading to second period, grabbing from an assortment of fruit and granola bars available in each room. Once class was in session, they took notes and asked questions with the attentiveness of teachers' pets. The cohort included guys who have been out of the league for years and free agents hoping to catch on with the team. Others, like McLaurin, 29, are still at the peak of their game. A self-described planner, McLaurin said the boot camp is about positioning himself for his next act, whenever that may come. A lot of guys think, oh, I'll figure it out when I'm done, he said. There's hardly been any guys who have been successful with that. McLaurin sat in the third row during Madelon's presentation, feverishly taking notes. Seated behind him was Long, a former Pro Bowler for the Chicago Bears. Long comes by both football and broadcasting naturally. His dad, Howie, was a Hall of Fame defensive end and has been an analyst on Fox's beloved pregame show since 1994. Growing up, Long spent weekends at the Fox studio in Los Angeles, mixing it up with Terry Bradshaw and Jimmy Johnson. The guys on that desk, Long said, they're my uncles, essentially. Long already serves as an analyst for a pregame show on CBS Sports Network and co-hosts a podcast that covers the NFL. But even with his experience, Long thought a few days at the boot camp could do him well because it was an opportunity to be around the masters and broaden his repertoire. While his dream job is to be an analyst on the NFL Today, CBS's flagship Sunday pregame show, Long also attended to get reps calling games from the booth. I knew I wanted to do studio, he said, but you come to this boot camp and you get to try on a couple different pairs of pants. The boot camp origin story begins with Vaughn Bryant, a former manager in the NFL's player development office. Bryant worked to help players find professional opportunities outside of football, a chapter that comes sooner than later for most. The average length of an NFL career spans only about 3 years, and Bryant's job was to provide resources to ease the transition to civilian life. Bryant once made that transition himself. After being drafted by the Detroit Lions in 1994, he bounced around the league for a couple of years before hanging up his cleats. With his playing career over, Bryant landed an internship at CNN, where a producer invited him to sit behind an anchor's desk and simulate a studio show. Years later, when he started his job in player development, he kept thinking back to that day, and then he got inspired. I was like, wait a minute, we could recreate this at the NFL Network or at NFL Films, and we can bring in all of our network partners, simulate every discipline, and do that for our players, Bryant said. He went to his next meeting with the pitch in his back pocket. I already had a name for it, the NFL Broadcast Boot Camp, he recalled. Bryant figured he'd have a year to get the program off the ground. His bosses had other ideas. They were like, nah, you gotta do this as soon as possible, he said. In June 2007, about half a year after Bryant floated the idea, the inaugural boot camp was held at the headquarters of NFL Films in Mount Laurel, New Jersey. Early interest was minimal. Only about 30 players applied. But players talked, word spread, and by the second year, the league received close to 100 applicants. You do it once, and anything that the players have a good experience with, they're going to tell their teammates, said Bryant. The boot camp has evolved with the media landscape, tailoring its curriculum to a world now dominated by podcast, social media, and smartphones. But the shift is perhaps most evident in the players themselves, with this year's campers boasting considerably more media experience than their predecessors. Along with Long, the group also included Wilson and former wide receiver Stevie Johnson, who work as analysts for the Canadian sports channel TSN. Avant, meanwhile, is a commentator for several local outlets in Philadelphia. Player-hosted podcasts have come to saturate the medium in recent years, with shows led by NFL stars such as Jason and Travis Kelce and Micah Parsons among the biggest in the genre. That represents another shift, specifically in what teams permit. Jason McCourty, an analyst for CBS, said that coaches and front office personnel expected a player's focus to be entirely on football when he entered the league in 2009. If you were drafted and you're talking about starting a podcast or how you're going to be on a local TV station, teams would look at you crazy, said McCourty, who attended the boot camp in 2022. Now, he added, teams are seeing there's no way to avoid it. These days, with players Instagramming and TikToking their lives, they no longer need the platform or infrastructure provided by a legacy company to express their views, nor do they have to wait until retirement to launch their media careers. I think in the beginning, the NFL didn't want players to have too much of a voice outside of what was available, said former standout defensive end Michael Bennett, who attended this year's boot camp. And now it's like every player has a voice. Bennett is eyeing a role on a studio show where he plans to talk differently from the rest of the commentariat. I think people always have the same conversations, he said. I think my ability to mix knowledge and humor is the key. As candid as he is charismatic, Bennett might have thrived in this current era of player-led podcast. He and the other campers were able to try their hand at the medium, participating in a mock segment hosted by Cameron Jordan, a defensive end for the New Orleans Saints and podcaster who attended last year's boot camp. Bennett chopped it up with Jordan and fellow camper Jalen Smith, a linebacker for the Las Vegas Raiders. The boot camp is the NFL's most popular player development program and its most successful. According to the league, 2/3 of attendees have gone on to receive either part-time or full-time opportunities as a result of their participation, and that track record has made it competitive. The NFL received 104 applications for the 24 slots available at this year's camp. We want the guy who loves the game, the guy who's going to talk about it in a way where I'm going to watch every game because now I care about it as much as him, said Tracy Perlman, senior vice president of player operations at the NFL. Those who didn't get admitted can take solace in the story of an ex-punter who applied 3 times but never got in. His name? Pat McAfee, the often sleeveless commentator whose contract with ESPN is reportedly valued at $17 million a year. J.J. Jansen, a long snapper for the Carolina Panthers, first applied in 2010. He didn't have much media experience then, but in recent years, Jansen has hosted a podcast for the team and appeared on local radio. That experience helped him get selected to the boot camp this year. After calling a simulated game with NBC's Noah Eagle, Jansen got a feel for the unique rhythms between a play-by-play announcer and color commentator. He would listen for things that I said, then he'd come back and set me up, and then it becomes conversational, Jansen said. Producers encouraged Jansen to be more willing to levy criticism, an unavoidable part of the job that many players enjoy the least. I shouldn't feel like I'm crushing anybody, Jansen said of the guidance. When you're a broadcaster, you've got to bring your own opinion. I think one of the toughest things for players is being perceived as a hater or turning on players. But once you're in broadcasting, your audience isn't former players or current players. Your audience is the fan. Jansen has also gained experience working behind the scenes with his close friend and former Panthers teammate Greg Olsen, a game analyst for Fox. The two spend time discussing various scenarios that may arise in a game, and in the playoffs, Jansen has joined Olsen in the booth to serve as a spotter, helping the analyst identify tacklers and pass catchers. He told me that watching Olsen, who has earned plaudits for his ability to explain the sometimes arcane strategy and rules of football, has helped shape his own understanding of the job. Anybody can hit keys on a piano, Jansen said. You have to know when and how to hit it. Players learn how to hit those proverbial keys at camp, a process that involves correcting their vocabulary. Use great, like you would use hot sauce, Madelon said in his presentation, just a little bit to enhance the moment. The following day, Fred Gaudelli, executive producer for NBC's coverage of the NFL, echoed the sentiment during a breakout session held in the Hail Mary conference room. If everything is great, Gaudelli said, nothing's great. In a different session, Howard Dinneroff explained that campers had to leave behind the team mentality. Never say we, said Dinneroff, the former executive producer at Westwood One. You're not we anymore. In virtually every session, the players were reminded that they can't simply rely on their experience in the NFL. This is not just showing up. This is a job, Madelon told them. This is not a football job, it's a communications job, talking about football. And they were told to expect grueling hours, especially if they want to call games as a color commentator like Troy Aikman, Tony Romo, or Tom Brady. I know you guys work your asses off during the week getting ready for a game, Gaudelli said during his session. It's not going to be any different here. It's going to be the same amount of hours, if not more. ESPN Saturday noted that some players aren't prepared for the workload. I think guys get in and go, wait a minute, dude, I actually got to go back home and watch this film, he said. This is just the reality. There are some players who were super successful in our game who probably didn't have to watch that much film. And then they get into this, and it's like, no, you can't fake what happened on Monday night. You better have watched the game when you talk about it. Campers were given a taste of what goes into a broadcast on the second day when they participated in a mock production meeting. As the campers sat around a long conference table in a room overlooking SoFi Stadium, producers from Fox, CBS, and Prime Video peppered them with questions about various storylines around the league, as if they were host of a studio show. When the discussion turned to the Pittsburgh Steelers, someone pointed out that the team's newly acquired star receiver, DK Metcalf, had just gotten engaged to the pop singer Normani. Perhaps that could spur Metcalf to even greater production. The comment was teed up perfectly for Bennett. "It's easier to get married than to get a mortgage," he quipped, "and I think it should be the opposite." The producers howled with approving laughter, telling Bennett that they would try to summon that line out of him on an actual show. It was a revealing moment, demonstrating how on-air banter is cultivated off-screen. But it also underscored an enduring truth of studio shows. At times, they are most compelling when the hosts veer outside their usual scope of coverage. Good television is good television, even if it has nothing to do with football. Bennett's quick wit makes him a natural for a studio role, which is why he's received inquiries from suitors in the weeks following the boot camp. But other players aren't as verbally gifted, even if they think they are. "We've been fooled into thinking everything we say is gold, but when you leave the NFL, you realize not everything you're saying is gold," said Burleson, whose hosting duties include work for the NFL Today and CBS Mornings. "And not only that, not everything you say is worth saying." Broadcasting also presents its own unique brand of pressure, given the public scrutiny that comes with being a part of the country's favorite television show. The NFL claimed 70 of the top 100 rated broadcasts in the United States last year, while expanding its footprint in the streaming world with a Christmas Day doubleheader on Netflix. Last February's Super Bowl between the Eagles and Kansas City Chiefs, meanwhile, was the most viewed single network telecast ever, with an audience of 127.7 million. When you have the opportunity to entertain tens of millions of people, the bar is incredibly high, said Teitelman, and it should be. A comic book fan, Teitelman invoked the famous Spider-Man axiom, "With great power comes great responsibility." The media personalities who cover the league populate the NFL's extended universe, drawing their share of the country's obsessive gaze. Just as the turnover-prone quarterback can expect scorn on social media and in newspaper columns, the same goes for a tongue-tied broadcaster. "Look, I'm not saying this is harder than playing football," Godelli said, "but this isn't easy." The Long Goodbye, Erica Jong, feminist icon and literary celebrity, was a dominant force in the culture and my life. Watching my mother slide into dementia is a reminder of the fleeting nature of fame. By Molly Jong Fast. From How to Lose Your Mother, A Daughter's Memoir, by Molly Jong Fast, to be published on June 3rd by Viking, an imprint of Penguin Publishing Group, a division of Penguin Random House. Copyright 2025 by Molly Jong Fast. My mother coined an expression for casual sex, the zipless F. Now think about being the offspring of the person who wrote that phrase. And pour one out for me. I grew up with Erica Jong everywhere, on television, in the crossword puzzle, in the newspaper. She was a kind of second-wave feminist, a white feminist, and a highly educated, wildly affluent Jewish and somewhat out-of-touch everywoman. But she wasn't an actual everywoman, of course. She was too famous for that. Too famous and too special. She was famous for her book Fear of Flying, and then later she was famous for being famous. And then, eventually, she wasn't famous anymore. Because fame, like youth, is fleeting. It deserts you when you least expect it. The wheel of fortune is always spinning. My mother never got over being famous. Even years after people stopped coming up to us in stores, even years after she slipped from the public consciousness, the virus of fame had made her someone different. Becoming normal like the rest of us, the journey to unfamousness was for her an event so strange and stressful, so damaging to her ego that she was never able to process it. My grandfather, the writer and communist Howard Fast, his most famous novel was Spartacus, adapted into an even more famous movie directed by Stanley Kubrick, and starring my grandfather's nemesis Kirk Douglas, had the curse too. He was unable to become unfamous, to slip back into the world the rest of us occupy, the world of emptying the dishwasher and picking up your prescriptions, and the world of not having people stop you on the street to tell you every detail of their lives. My grandfather was a best-selling author who published more than 80 books. But now no one, other than a very narrow subset of the elderly, has heard of him. I never knew my mother or grandfather in the height of their respective fames, but I did know them at the end, when they were desperately trying to claw fame back from the writers who they believed had taken it from them. Watching my mother's failed metamorphosis back to normal made me a sort of fame hobbyist, like a bird watcher without the birds. For the addictive personality, the junky itch from coming off celebrity can never, ever be cured, not with all the adoration in the world. Mom was never a normal person again. My stepfather, Ken, tried to keep her in the style to which she was accustomed, tried to treat her like a queen. Maybe it worked. I don't know. I never knew her when she was unfamous. She would always say that I was everything to her. She would always tell anyone who listened that I was her greatest accomplishment in life. I always knew that wasn't the truth. I wondered if other people had the same connection issue with her that I did. I found her distracted and disinterested, impossible to connect with. I always just assumed this was some personal failing on my part, just assumed the problem was me. But maybe other people felt the same way. They also assumed they were the problem. It would have been helpful to have a sibling to commiserate with, but I was my mother's only child. Everyone told me she loved me so much, but I never felt all that loved. Later on, I realized that I never felt that anyone loved me. For my entire life, random people have come over to talk to me about my mom. They wanted me to know how much they loved Fear of Flying. They wanted me to know how important her work was to them. They wanted to talk about her fame, about her inflammatory comments about sex. Sometimes they'd tell me some embarrassing things she'd said about me on television. Sometimes they'd tell me about some embarrassing things she'd written about me. But starting 4 years ago, when I was writing for the Daily Beast and obsessed with tweeting, things started to change. People were no longer coming up to me to tell me they had seen her on Charlie Rose or Good Morning America. And Charlie Rose didn't have a show anymore. He'd been canceled. Now people were coming up to me for a different reason, for one of those hard conversations. They would seem almost apologetic. They would pause before they spoke, their voices heavy with a kind of shame, a deep kind of embarrassment. It's always been hard for me not to find the discomfort of others deeply unpleasant. I'd encourage them to say whatever it was they wanted to. But did I want to hear it? Their voices would inevitably be hushed and perhaps a bit halting. Sometimes the person would take my hand. "How is your mother?" they would ask. And then they would offer up one of the following comments. "Is your mom okay? Are you sure she's okay? She seems off. She can't remember anything. There's something really wrong with her." Everywhere I went in my little neighborhood, I found myself surrounded by people who wanted to talk to me about my mother's failing memory and her increasingly erratic behavior. At the bookstore, at the hair salon, on the corner, everywhere I went, my mother's condition followed me. I went to a British restaurant for dinner with my husband and a famous poet, which is kind of an oxymoron, I know, and the poet's wife, a novelist. At the end of the dinner, the wife told me she had something to say that might upset me. "No, it's okay," I said. Was it okay? Who knows? I've always floated around like some kind of Erica Jong Rorschach test. I am a repository for people's feelings about my mother, about feminism, about the sexual revolution. And then, of course, there's the little issue that my mother has never had a filter. She'd always say the worst possible thing. That was one of her trademarks. Sometimes, when I'd be sitting at a dinner or watching her give a talk, a thought would pop into my mind. What is the worst possible thing she could say? And without fail, she'd say it. I remember watching in horror as someone live-tweeted her appearance at a book festival. I couldn't control what she said or what people thought about her. But at least I could control one thing. When I was young, I decided not to read her books. I braced myself for whatever the poet's wife was going to say. She explained that she had posted a photograph of her deceased father on Instagram. She picked up her phone to show me the post. I considered the picture of the woman's father. He looked like all deceased fathers, old. "Your mother posted a comment on the photo," she said. "Okay." I was so past feeling embarrassed by things my mother said and did. I lived in this kind of perpetual post-embarrassment state. I could take this. "The comment your mother wrote was neat." The woman looked as if she were going to cry. I thought about my mother commenting on a picture of someone's dead father with the word neat. And then it became difficult for me to think about much of anything else. I called my stepfather. He had been a divorce lawyer. He was always ready to have a disagreement. Not a fight, exactly, but a sort of conflict, the kind I always hated. "Hi, Ken," I said. "Mal," he replied. He always called me Mal. "We have to talk about Mom." He laughed. It was a pained laugh, an uncomfortable laugh. "Mom is acting strangely," I said. Ken cleared his throat. "Mom is losing her memory," I said. I could hear my mother's two poodles barking in their apartment. I've known Ken since I was 11 years old. I knew the throat clearing meant that he was getting prepared to lecture me about the thing everyone was telling me was true. Ken was one of those people who became a lawyer because he liked to fight, and he fought with anyone he could find. One of my more crushing childhood memories occurred when he yelled at a waiter because the restaurant didn't have his preferred mustard brand. He gave the waiter a 20 to go to the nearest deli and buy his stupid mustard. The waiter actually did it. That's how terrifying Ken was. But he could also be very kind. He often did my friends' divorces and undercharged them, or didn't charge them at all. He was never cruel to me. I did, however, feel that he believed he was put upon this earth to protect my mother from me. "Look, Maul, this is a hearing problem," Ken said. I had spent so many years arguing with him about what reality was and what reality wasn't, and each time he would tell me my reality was wrong and his was right. I hated arguing. I hated it. "She just needs hearing aids." "Ken," I said, "this has nothing to do with hearing. She has dementia." "Ah, Maul," he said, "you know she's just thinking of her next book." But Mom hadn't written a book in a long time. The last thing she'd published was a book of poetry with a publisher that seemed like a vanity press. They had asked her for a donation. I'm not an economist or anything, but I think the publisher is supposed to pay the author. And suddenly I was 13 again, begging my stepfather to get my mother to stop taking diet pills or to have her slow down on the drinking. Everyone told me I was crazy in that case, too. They would tell me that my mom didn't drink too much. She was just tired. She was just passed out on the bed, eye makeup smeared all over her face, lipstick everywhere. She was just working on another book. She was just under a lot of pressure. Ken would inevitably declare, "Once she gets her book done, then she'll be back to normal." 30 years later, and I was having the exact same conversation with him. But this time, at 44, I finally knew my reality was right and his was wrong. There was no book. There would never be another book. Her last tycoon, her swan song, was to be an autobiography called Selfie. She had gotten the idea that Selfie was a good title, because at a memorial service for a friend, she had run into David Remnick, the editor-in-chief of The New Yorker. She had told Remnick the title, and she had decided he had liked it. It was not completely clear if this had actually happened, or happened in the way my mom was reporting it, but it didn't matter. That was her version of the story. It was always her version of the story. "I think she's fine," Ken said calmly. One of the interesting things was that you could say anything to my mom and stepdad, like anything, and they wouldn't get mad at you. Ken did love fighting, but part of the reason he loved it was because he never got really angry. I told him that this was bordering on insane. I told him that everyone could see what was happening here. She wrote neat on someone's Instagram post about her dead father, like, "Gee whiz, that's so neat that your father died." "Eh," Ken said. That was one of the many baffling things about both of them. When presented with evidence that perhaps they were wrong, they would just ignore the evidence and continue on their merry way. This habit of theirs always made me feel insane. Ken was starting to display early symptoms of Parkinson's disease. He was in denial about that, too. One big difference between Mom and Ken, when Ken started losing his mind, he knew it. About 10 years ago, he had told us he wanted us to know because he had a job, which was nominally still being a lawyer, but was really taking care of my mother. He was in his 70s when he started forgetting, found himself to be less sharp. He started going to doctors. Doctors told him he was fine, but he knew. Soon after, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's. Then he sort of forgot about the anxiety that he was losing his mind and devoted himself to ignoring his Parkinson's. This tactic was a stark contrast to my mom, who was now unable to remember if she'd fed the dogs or if she'd had a phone call. Everyone who talked to Mom knew that there was something deeply wrong with her. I don't know how many people suspected dementia. Given her dreamy nature, she had never seemed sharp per se, but slowly, and then all of a sudden, she seemed completely lost. When confronted with this obvious fact, she would cover herself. She had many strategies. I'd misheard her. I had misunderstood her. She'd repeat a story she'd told me 5 minutes before, and I'd say, "You already told me this, Mom." Her response might be a defensive, "I know," as if the problem were mine for not appreciating that the story was important enough for her to keep repeating. Or she might try to change the subject by distracting me. Or she might just space out. She had a whole bag of tricks. I texted my cousin Harold, who's a doctor. I wanted to know what the symptoms of dementia were. He texted back, "Repetitive questions of things discussed and answered, short-term memory loss, lack any deep thought, and therefore quality of conversations diminished, facts that were shared on events, etc., became forgotten." Well, there you go. Check, 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 check. Confirmed. One evening, a couple of months later, I understood that her awareness of her condition had changed. She was sitting at the dining room table, drinking coffee and reading the paper when I came in the room. "Hey," I said. "Hi, darling." She got up. Her silk robe was open, and you could see her naked body. She was never good at keeping her robe closed. This was true both metaphorically and literally. She hugged me. She kissed me. She told me she loved me in an effusive way that was clearly not the way her own cold, mean mom did it. We sat down at the dining room table. I tried not to look at her boob, which was unfortunately somewhat visible. I spent way too much time thinking about getting older and about how ruthless the march of time was on the body. I asked her if she wanted a cappuccino. She said she was okay. "Mom, guess what?" I asked. "I saw your friend Judy at an event." "I just run into her old pal, the folk singer Judy Collins. Judy looked great, very thin and elegant and dressed all in black. She smelled great, too. Judy asked me how my mom was, because everyone always asked me how my mom was. I did not want to lie to Judy about my mother's increasingly demented condition. So I just made a face and said, "Meh." "Who?" Mom asked. "Your friend Judy, the singer." There was a faraway look in her eyes. "Judy," she said. "Judy?" I reminded her that she made Judy sing the Joni Mitchell song, "Both Sides Now," at my wedding. Collins had a hit with it in 1968. "Judy," Mom declared, "of course." But I could tell she was lying. She had no clue who Judy was. Her voice always changed when she lied, became just the slightest bit more tentative. And then she said, "I don't remember who that is." That was the moment I realized she knew she couldn't cover anymore. She still wouldn't admit that she had dementia, but she would now occasionally admit that her memory wasn't what it used to be. And then she kept slipping away, less and less of her in my life, less and less of her on the page, less and less of her. Soon she would be just a faint fragment of a once great woman. She had been a force, a powerhouse, and now she was becoming an echo. But it's very important for you to understand that Mom is one of those people who is constitutionally incapable of being honest. She's been in denial about her drinking since I was born, for example. Mom couldn't accept that she had dementia until she was so far gone it was no longer a question. But even then, she remained not convinced. Neither did Ken. Well, we just don't agree, Ken told me on the phone. I'm taking her to the dementia doctor, I said. My mother is just a body now. She has dementia. She has breath and hair and pretty blue eyes. But Erica Jong, the person, has left the planet. My grandmother, my mother's mother, also had dementia and died at the exceptionally advanced age of 100+. Running through her money with a nurse she thought was some kind of family member or friend. But that nurse had her own family. I wasn't good about visiting Grandma. I was one of 9 grandchildren, and I used that as an excuse, diffusing the responsibility. But the truth was, I just hated the idea of my grandma sitting in that bed, in a state between living and dead. Or maybe I was just a bad, selfish person. Or maybe I just didn't like old people, the reminder that death was around the corner, inching toward us. Grandma died, then Mom will die, and then I will. That's the best-case scenario. The worst-case scenario is that these things are out of order. Like my grandmother, my mother will likely continue on for the next 25 years in a state of dreamy, distracted unreality. She will become increasingly unreachable. I recently gave an interview to NPR about my mother. The interviewer and I spoke in that weird, slightly halting NPR way. I kept flipping from the present to the past tense. She was, she is. I couldn't quite agree with myself about if she was still on this planet or already gone. I was a bad daughter. I am a bad daughter. The horrible irony is that she has always seemed a bit demented. Maybe not demented exactly, but distracted, dreamy, head in the clouds and detached. When I was a little red-haired girl, like Little Orphan Annie, but fat, I would yell at my mother for spacing out. I used to beg her to focus, to pay attention to me. Where did you go? I'd ask her as she stared into space. My mother has these very glassy blue eyes. I would look into them and wonder if she saw me at all. Sometimes I'd wonder if I was real. Years later, I would interview a journalist about Elon Musk, and the journalist would tell me that there was evidence to support the supposition that Musk believed he was in a simulation. The journalist continued, "A lot of rich and famous people believe that the world is a simulation for their benefit, because otherwise, how could things have worked out so well for them?" I've been thinking a lot about this idea that the entire world is just a simulation for your benefit. Eventually, Mom would answer, but never the question I ask. Disassociation has always been her magic trick, her way of remaining in the world, but also not. Was it her chronic dreaminess that made it impossible to tell if she was merely distracted or if she was disappearing? This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock. Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.